Hi, I'm Tony Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. Big shout out to this episode's sponsor, XL Coffee. XL are renowned organic coffee producers here in the UK who have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure their coffee is mold-free and has kept its antioxidant potency. XL are waking up the world of coffee. I'm a big fan and recommend you go give them a try. Use discount code NATLIFEPOD at checkout. Details are in the show notes. You may have heard or been inspired by the Couch to 5K movement. Well, let me introduce you to the mobility scooter to Marathoner and beyond. My next guest, Sam Fire-Hayes, shares a story of true healing and transformation. Sam talks to her healing journey from being a couch-bound chronic pain sufferer on pain meds to a thriving, marathoning natural lifestyle coach, and how healing herself through a holistic approach which combines natural movement, natural nutrition, mindfulness, nature immersion, and a whole heap of self-love and compassion now gets to help empower others on their healing journey too. If you're looking for inspiration, then this conversation with Sam will no doubt tick that box. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did. Sam Fire-Hayes, behind the mic. This is your first time behind a mic.
It is, yes.
Yay! We're popping chairs, Sam's cherry. Amazing. How you feeling today?
Yeah, good.
Yeah? We did a bit of breath. We down-regulated. That feels nice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How's it feel to be with the cameras here?
A bit.
Yeah, it does, right? I remember my first pod, it felt very much like that. But it is just a chat, right? It's just a conversation. Mm. And we know each other well.
Yes.
Been on a bit of a journey. You've been on some journey. It's really inspiring. You know, I have this, we're awe-inspiring beings and we have everything inside of ourselves to be the change. And you have definitely walked that path. So it's great to have you on here to share your story.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you for accepting the call. Let's start with your name change, you know? Because okay. Sam Fire-Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
When we first met, it
was not my name.
It was not your name.
No.
So what brought around the change? What brought that change in for you?
So I am getting divorced.
Yeah.
And I wanted to change my surname because I didn't feel that I was still Morris. And didn't want to go back to my maiden name because I felt like stepping back to someone that I'm not anymore. Yeah. And so, yeah, just searched for a name and landed on Hayes, which has some meaning behind it for me. And Samfire was a nickname that was given to me by somebody in the NatLife tribe, a very good friend of mine. And it came...
You got the NatLife tribe plug-in so early.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for that. Well, Sam's a member of the NatLife tribe.
I am. Yes. So, yeah, and it came from, she was like, Sam, you're on fire at the minute. You're Sam Fire. And then she's like, right, I'm going to call you Sam Fire from now on. So then she did, and I quite liked it. And then I kind of took it on board as a nickname. Mm. And then quite like people calling me Sam Fire. So I thought, well, I'm going to change my surname anyway. Going to do the deed poll thing. So why not change the first name as well? And it's, yeah, quite empowering to choose your own name. And I feel like... kind of emerging from a lot of the stuff and the work that I've been doing, and it's like I'm emerging as this new identity while still, you know, past Sam's coming along too. Not detaching myself from that, but just embracing this new human that I am.
Yeah, there can be an element of grief involved with like the letting go of that person, right?
Yeah, and I've done a lot of grief work around that, and yeah. I recently did a sort of rebirthing process in a pool, which kind of felt like a sort of baptism almost to my new identity, but also a grieving and a letting go of, it was quite symbolic for me to kind of bring that in, that I was letting go of the past version and then embracing the new one and baptized into Samfire Hayes. So yeah, it was quite a good process.
I can see that really taking off, you know, like birthing pool suddenly exploded. We have rebirthing pools. We were discussing this earlier in the sauna, right? And we were talking about Hackney baths, right? And I was speaking to 9 years ago, I think I held a men's retreat and it was at 42 acres, And they have this, it's called the Frieda Suite. It's the suite that's in the main house and has this huge bathroom. And the kids loved it when we lived there because they could just finally get a bath upstairs in the house, which they loved that room. Anyway, it had a big roll top bath in the middle of the room. And I held a men's retreat. So we're all sitting around this big tub and one would get in and we'd be banging drums and beating on the floor and helping, guiding that person get through that process of 2 or 3 minutes in the cold. But we were unpacking, you know, could you imagine like this conversation years back, right? You're going to get into a bath water that 12 people before you have just got into. And it's amazing where things are going and what we're shifting and the breakthroughs we're having, right?
Yeah.
Through these practices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The water's been a big medicine for me, the cold and the warm. But yeah, specifically the cold water, because I started doing that a long time ago, actually. I just heard that it was good for sore muscles. And so I just was drawn to it. And I would go to my local gym where they had a cold plunge and I'd sit in it for 4 minutes. I found out online somewhere, someone told me 4 minutes at the time. And I would sit there for 4 minutes and people would look at me like, what's she doing? Mm-hmm. She's there for 4 minutes. But I was in so much pain in my body that the contrast of the sort of impact of the water, I think it was a relief for me. And then more recently, you know, in the last couple of years, engaging as a conscious practice with the breath and using it for not just pain, physical, but, you know, mental practice as well.
Yeah, and everything outside the tub, not just in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was, when you first came to the house in Somerset and you came for a one-day immersion, and I was quite surprised at how you just were in that cold. We were in there, what was it, like 10 minutes or something?
It was 22 minutes.
22 minutes, there we go. It's like an incredible length of time.
I was waiting for you to tell me to get out and you were waiting for me to finish.
But you were just so comfortable in there, you know?
I was, yeah.
Yeah, I think that the rebirthing pool part of the conversation doesn't do the whole rebirthing justice. That makes sense. It's kind of almost feels like it's, you've put all this cake mixture together. You spend hours preparing the mixture. You spend hours watching it rise in the oven. And then the person that lights the candle at the end of it gets, that's it, right? Or blowing out the candle and we forget the huge process that we go through, right? So, you know, there's a journey there. I spoke to this because I share your story on the coaching certs about change and how through simple practices again, well, really just getting you, I guess going back to getting your needs met,
mm-hmm.
we can start to heal, right? And there is a process through that. Of course, there has to be the mind that wants to enter that to begin with. But through simple practices, we can start to heal, right? And I express it as mobility scooter to marathon, you know, because that's a huge journey. And then if we then go from marathon to then rebirthing pool, that seems like it's another journey. It's like the physical stuff, boom.
Mm-hmm.
That then enables you to go right next layer, next layer, next layer.
Yeah. Well,
Can we go into the mobility scooter and what that journey was like for you and what you were going through at that time, what you were processing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You feel like sharing that?
Yeah. So I was a reasonably fit person, wasn't particularly healthy, but, you know, mobile. And then started having problems in my first pregnancy with my pelvis. And then they didn't go away. I had a lot of trauma. My father died and there was a whole chaos that happened around that and his mental health declined before he died. And so I think that kind of merged itself with what was physically going on in my body. And then the pain never left. And then it got worse with my second pregnancy. I was pretty much bedbound by the end of my second pregnancy, really struggling to walk. And again, the doctor said, oh, we'll kind of go away. Never did. And then looking back now, I realised there was this fear of moving because it felt like if I moved, I was in more pain. So then I just became very immobile and didn't really go out. Sometimes I was having to walk with crutches. And it was the pain was variable. So some days I would always be in pain, but some days would be less and I'd kind of get some stuff done and I'd manage things. And then other times I would barely be able to walk to the bathroom, you know, so it was really unpredictable as well, which was really hard to deal with and probably was influenced by stress, probably more by stress than by movement. But at the time,
quite stressful even to transition between those both, because there's moments when I'm not in pain, maybe this is happening. And then within a very short window of time, you're back in the cave again.
Yeah. Well, it would happen.
The stress of just those two worlds, right, colliding.
Yeah. I could be walking down the street, you know, gone out to do some shopping, and then all of a sudden I couldn't walk.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have my crutches with me, and I'd just have to kind of stand there. And at the time, didn't have any, you know, like now, if something like that were to happen, I would do some down regulation breath, I'd move, or, I'd, you know, I didn't have any tools.
You have the modalities
to
now,
use. Yeah. I just was like, oh, I can't walk now. And then I would get very upset and embarrassed. And often the people that I was with, if I was with someone, they might get frustrated because they'd be like, well, you were fine a second ago. And like, now you can't walk. And yeah, it was...
They can't relate.
They couldn't relate, you know, and it is hard. And I used to wish that I like had some kind of colour, like I'd go purple when I was in like a higher level of pain so people would understand. Because from the outside, I didn't look disabled, but I was at times.
Mm.
And there was no... At the time, it didn't seem, I'm sure if I were to track it back, there probably would be some kind of correlation I could look at and see what was influencing it. But at the time, it seemed completely random and like I had no control over it.
But also, you're in a real survival state, aren't you?
Yeah.
To be able to even zoom out and look at that.
Yeah. And it was, so it was 2017 was really when it got bad because I herniated my disc, which was probably from a lack of movement. And then I spent pretty much 8 months on the sofa, left the house to drop the kids at school, come back on the sofa till pick up time, back on the sofa.
Yeah, and I think that's an important part to voice again, right? Is you're also the full-time mum in this position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very young kids. And didn't talk to anyone. So like on the school run, I would have my eyes down. So I wouldn't make eye contact with anybody because then I'd have to talk to them and then I'd spend longer on my feet. So I was literally just wanted to get them in. I'd park in the disabled bay at the school. So it was the closest and then, you know, walk in, eyes down, and then picking up kids who were like jumping all over you. And I really, for a long period of time, had a sensitivity to touch. I found touch really, really difficult and like hugging my kids, you know.
There's a resistance there.
Because it was painful. Yeah. And I was, you know, really, really stressed because... Well, I had PTSD as well. So, you know, both those things gave me, and I was sensitive to touch and sound. Once I figured that out, that was really helpful. I wasn't aware. I was just like, I'm like,
yeah.
And like, if I was in a high level of pain and the radio was on and the kids are trying to touch me and, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm like exploding, you know, and I was a not very nice person at times, losing my temper with people around me.
Different scale of Sam on fire.
Yeah.
Sam's on fire. Yeah, she's on fire right now.
There'd be like a wrath that would come out, and I would just, you know, I don't consider myself to be an angry person, but that was what was coming out because I didn't know. Switch the sound off. Take a moment. Take some breaths. You know, I didn't have any of those coping. Just was completely unaware of how to manage it. And also I was very stuck in, this is happening to me. This is so unfair. No one else has got this. Why have I got this? No one understands what it's like to have this. And, you know, the doctors were very unhelpful. Although I was in a process where I was wanting the drugs. I was wanting someone to fix me. I was going to the doctors and saying, well, this drug doesn't work and this drug. And they got increasingly higher and higher and higher. So I had anti-seizure medications for pain. I had antidepressants for pain. I was on morphine at one point, benzodiazepines, like just they threw everything at me and all at the same time. And then I was also drinking heavily as well. So it was like I'm having... opioids, benzodiazepines, alcohol as a cocktail, and I'm trying to look after my kids. You know, it was really, really unhealthy and a lot of real negativity from the doctors. So I rang my doctor once and said, I'm drinking loads because the medicines aren't working and I really don't want to. Can you help me? And he said, you're just making excuses so you can drink. You're going to be in pain for the rest of your life, Sam. So you just need to cope with that.
Wow, what a support system.
That's exactly the words he said to me.
And here's more meds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I felt very stuck. Yeah. And and then the mobility scooter came in because I couldn't really go out with the children. So my ex-husband was taking them on, like, you know, they'd go out to the farm or, you know, they'd go on a day out with the kids. And he was taking them without me because I couldn't walk very far or didn't feel like I was scared to walk. So potentially there was more ability than I thought back then, but I just, you know, sometimes I couldn't walk.
Well, there's a fear there, isn't there, of being then thrust back into that level of pain.
Yeah, well, sometimes
back
if
on the meds, back on the booze, and the cycle continues.
Sometimes if I did kind of push myself and go, okay, well, we're going to go to Sainsbury's or whatever, then I would see a correlation. The next day, I'd be in agony. And so then I'd be like, oh, well, that's because I went. And I don't actually know, is it because I went and moved? Possibly, but would that have happened anyway? Because it doesn't seem to be a pattern. So it was real trapped in that fear cycle. And we got the mobility scooter. It was I'd been told by the doctors, this is you. You know, I was given a fibromyalgia diagnosis and told that's it. And I thought my journey at that point was to accept that I was disabled. So I got a blue badge. Got the mobility scooter so I could go out with the kids. And in reality, I didn't use it that much because I was so embarrassed to be in a mobility scooter at young age and people would look at me. And
so, yeah, let's bring age into this. How old were you then?
So this is the whole of my 30s, basically. Yeah. And there was a real embarrassment. And I, even my crutches, so I would keep them in the car and I would only use them if I absolutely had to. So I just walk slowly and kind of struggle because people ask and they go, oh, what have you done to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like
curiosity.
Then I don't really want to sit and explain that actually this is a chronic condition and, you know, kind of go into all of that. So I would avoid using the things that at the time I thought were, you know, my things to help me. So the few coping mechanisms I did have, I didn't even want to use because they felt embarrassing. And I was torn between, oh, I need to accept this disabled label that I've been given.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be disabled and I don't, it's embarrassing to be disabled. Like I don't want to have this, I want to be fit and be able to be a good mother to my kids and go and dance. And, you know, I want to do that. I don't want to. So it was a real struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And and really, really stuck in that victim until, because people ask me, they're like, what was the turning point?
Yeah, what
for you?
Is that turning point? What's and the I'm like, ignition of
I don't
that?
Think there was one. I think it was a gradual drip. And part of it was training as a counsellor.
Yeah.
And I would have to write weekly journals that then my tutor would read. Sort of processing stuff that was coming up and every single one started with, I'm in this level of pain this week or, you know, and then I realized, oh, I'm my whole identity is my pain.
But then you can say, well, what sparked the need to become a counselor therapist? What kind of came in?
So that was because I had to leave my old job.
Yeah.
Because that was too physical. So physically I couldn't do it anymore. I had done a psychology degree and had always been interested in counselling. I'd had my own counselling after my father died.
Yeah.
And so there was a spark to, okay, well, I'll retrain as a therapist. And then that process, I realised that I identified my pain and I also started to just unpack a whole load of stuff. I started to love myself, actually. I started to be like, actually... Yeah, because I hated myself. I hated my body. I hated that I was angry and screaming at everybody all the time. And, you know, and I started to understand that, Sam, and why that was happening. And then...
So more compassion drops in at that
stage. Compassion and some kind of self-love and self-worth was coming in. And then, okay, so probably the biggest thing was I read The Body Keeps the Score.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw, I don't even know how many doctors. I had a pain psychologist. I had all sorts of people. Not one person said to me, oh, you have trauma and chronic pain. Those two things are linked. Yeah. No one did. And I read this book and I just went, this is my life.
Oh my God.
What?
Yeah, in that moment.
Really? And so then I was like, okay. And the seed was then planted, and then I started to kind of look at the neuroscience around pain, and really starting to understand, and also look at the fear part that was actually driving a lot of, and so really working on releasing the fear.
Mm.
And I started to adopt this attitude of, okay, what can I achieve today with the pain level I'm in right now? I'm going to worry about tomorrow. What's going on with my body now? Yeah. I actually started to check in with my body
in the moment.
Well, whereas before I just didn't want to go into my body because it was so painful. So it was just like, try and ignore what it's telling me. And I think, you know, reading that book, I finally understood that my body wasn't broken. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
Mm.
It's trying to keep me safe. It's just, you know, doing it in a way that is very inconvenient and very painful. But actually I was there, my body's broken. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
And here's the meds and everything else to dumb down the signal of all the approach that the body's trying to take.
So really stepping in and listening to my body and going, okay, this is the pain I'm in right now. So what can I do? Can I, you know, look at the tasks that I needed to do with getting the kids ready or making dinner or, you know, whatever it was. Can I do that? Yeah, I can. I'll do it. And then, okay, yeah, maybe the next day I have a big flare up and I can't make dinner. Okay, I kind of went to more moment, being in the moment with the pain rather than this, what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day or the next day. And so breaking that fear was really important. And I had been practicing mindfulness and doing breath work and really getting in touch with the breath and how that can be, you know, really helpful for down regulation. I hadn't made the correlation between being down regulated and less pain because that came later. But so that was really important to bring that in. I was starting to become more active. I was going out and walking with the dogs. You know, to begin with, it was like a 20-minute walk. And then gradually was able to increase. And that was over a couple of years. I was gradually starting to get more and more and more mobile. And then...
Which is a big step, you know, if you go back to the, you know, there's heading into Sainsbury's and there's... Sainsbury's is getting a good plug here, right? There's heading into the...
actually shop in Sainsbury's.
There's a heading into the supermarket.
Yeah.
Which might have changed now, right? It could be the farmer's market. Into the supermarket. And now we're unpacking, it's possibly not the walk into the supermarket, it's the fear of walking into the supermarket and the fear of what that might lead to then over the next few coming days after.
But also now understanding that because I was scared, I'm like this.
Yeah,
right?
So it's triggering your nervous system.
So I'm not even walking normally.
No,
I'm not relaxed.
Everything gets jacked.
So I'm like, I'm walking around. My muscles were rigid all of the time. All of the time they were just, you know, because some of the therapies that I then kind of went into were massage. Massage has been a really big part of helping me. And, you know, the massage therapist at one point was coming once a week when I was like really starting to recover, because we were like, okay, we're going to just keep, because every time he'd like loosen everything off. And then like within 24 hours, it was back rigid again. And within a couple of months of him coming once a week, or maybe about 3 months, he said to me, Sam, this might sound strange, but you've got a normal bum now, because my glutes were just rock hard all of the time. And he was like, it's actually really released and it's not. And it was, you know, a combination of the massage and the down regulation practices and really bringing my body out of this, you know, fight.
Yeah, it's you know, because I often speak to the physical, social, spiritual needs, right? And we need to get our needs met. But if you unpack it and you say, okay, well, walking is a need because a movement is a need.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm moving, so therefore there's less suffering. But actually, how am I moving? How am I walking? Am I really upregulated? how much tension. So it's not then the movement, the sleep, the food, the rest.
Hmm.
Well, rest is in there now in that conversation, because it's the rest and the air breathing is a physical need. Hmm. So we could say, right, through breath and rest, you get to really calm that nervous system down.
Yeah.
And therefore, the movement need can be better met, you know, because it aligns more. It's in alignment, let's say, with what walking would truly be like in a natural environment where we would be down regulated unless the threat comes in, whereas you're in the threats come in, the threat's there. So how do we get back to that position of remaining calm again?
Yeah. But it was very kind of tentative, protective, need to protect my body steps rather than...
Well, the lion's there permanently.
It's not actually, I'm not actually moving properly. Mm. And So really it was the understanding my body's doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
The releasing of the fear and just becoming a bit more mobile.
When Sam Fear becomes Sam Fire.
Yeah. Well, I was offered a spinal fusion. I think that was also a turning point for me, because at the time I wanted to be offered that, because I was like, that my back was just, like I say, I spent 8 months on this, like literally 8 months on the sofa, barely moving. And I stopped drinking water because getting up and down to go to the toilet was so painful. So I just wouldn't drink.
And your water needs not met.
Yeah, exactly. But it was so excruciating. I'd be like screaming as I was like trying to stand up and then trying to sit back down, that movement on my back when it was just horrible. And again, you know, they said, oh, you know, once it's recovered, it'll go, but it never did. And then sitting became really, really difficult. And then when they offered me the spinal fusion, it was almost like, oh, okay, I'm being validated for my pain. There's something physically wrong with me that maybe you can fix. And then the more I looked into what a spinal fusion was, I was like, I don't think I want to do that. And there was something in me, because I had wanted the doctor, when he offered it to me, I was like, oh, yeah, you're listening to me. I'm going to get the surgery. Someone's going to fix me.
There's a finally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I was like, actually, like, there can be real big complications from this. And then it was a decision, do I have it, do I not? And I thought, well, no, I don't think that's a good idea, because I don't want it to be worse than it is now. And it could be after. And the surgeon, to be fair, was quite honest about that it could actually make it worse. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do? Because if I do nothing, then I'm stuck like this, you know? So that was then a motivator of, okay, you know, that doctor that said, you're going to be in pain for the rest of your life, Sam, you just need to accept it. I think that getting better was a little bit of a fuck you to him. It was like a motivation of like, okay.
A motivator, right?
Yeah. So there was a bit of like anger energy that kind of went into the motivation to get better. So it's kind
fire in your belly.
A combination of, like, there wasn't one thing. It was like a little drips of different things that came in. And I had seen Rangan Chatterjee's Doctor in the House, where he spent time with a woman who had a fibromyalgia diagnosis.
Oh, we were discussing this last night,
weren't
we? Yeah, yeah.
So that had planted a seed. That was years and years before. Mm. And it planted a seed, but it wasn't enough I was still kind of in victim, you know, that's not going to work for me. But I bought his book and I was kind of, okay, I'm interested. Then the book just gathered dust on the shelf for a bit. And then when I started to get into, well, when I started to learn these tools and started to understand things a bit better, kind of reconnected with that stuff. And then I listened to his podcast one day and there was a person on that podcast.
Yes.
And if I had heard you on that podcast, maybe even only a year before, I would have disregarded it completely.
It would have been like the conversation about people getting in the same bathwater.
I'd have just been like, and there was a bit of me listening to the podcast at the time that was like, well, that's okay for him. I mean, look at you, Tony. Like, I'm like, he's the barefoot ultra endurance athlete. It's fine for him to sit on the floor, you know. And as I was listening to it, I was like, meh. But it landed, and that was a seed. And I just kept, I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Couldn't not hear it.
I heard it and I was a bit, and, you know, talking about sitting on the floor and, you know, and I was just like, okay. And I mulled it over. And then it was 2 weeks later And I just went, right, okay. And I, even in the pain that I was in, I was on my own and I just got the sofa. The symbolism of getting rid of my sofa after it being my prison for 8 months, well, not just the 8 months, but there's that 8 month time that I associate with the sofa. The symbolism of that was like, I'm going to get rid of my prison, but also let's give it a go. And I kind of wanted to be all in. So I mean, I could have just sat on the floor and still had the sofa in the room, but I was like, if the sofa's there, then I might sit on it. So I'm just going to stick it in the garage. And that was 2 years ago. And the sofa has never come back.
There you go.
And it's nuts. Okay, so I started...
It's all nuts.
Yeah, it was all nuts.
Yeah.
I started ground sitting around July time, June, July. I came and saw you in the August, in the December.
What year are we talking?
This is 2 years ago.
2 years ago, yeah.
So
2020.
July,
yeah.
Started sitting on the floor. And when I first started sitting on the floor, I could sit for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Because my back just didn't like it. So I would then lie down and then I would sit back up again when I could and I would lie down. So that was July. Came for the immersion with you in August. December, I did a marathon.
Yeah.
And I still can't believe that it's that time.
You've been in the same sitting pose for like 20 minutes.
Oh, I sit all day.
You know, so what? Again, it's how relatable things are. And I think people really are attracted to that because there is that, oh, Tony's already, he's a barefoot endurance athlete. But the moment I bring in, oh yeah, well, there's this 82-year-old dude or there's this 77-year-old woman or there's this or this, and then it's, aha, okay. Well, if they're doing it, then I can do that. Have you heard of Terry Wall, like the Wall's Protocol?
Yeah, yeah.
That really was inspiring for me and for many. You know, how she had MS and she's in an electric wheelchair and really crippled by it. And she has that moment of, this isn't going to beat me. I need to figure out what my cells need and study cellular biology and then moves through, or here's the supplements I can take. And then that moves then into, well, if I can get that from supplements, well, I must be able to get it through my nutrition. And then there she is, she's on stage presenting slides of when she was in this electric wheelchair. It's like phenomenal, but so powerful when you hear stories like that.
Yeah.
More so than an endurance athlete basically speaking to this, oh yeah, I sit on the floor and I sawed my sofa up in the year this whatever. And that can be for some like, yeah, yeah, okay, that's never gonna happen for me.
It landed for me because I'd gotten to the place where I was trying to change and I was hopeful. I think before, you know, even a year before, I was still, there wasn't that hope, there wasn't the envisioning that I would get better because I was told I wouldn't. There was a desire to get better. And, you know, now there's part of me that still can't believe that I'm no longer in pain. And I realized I was forgetting. So I was forgetting at times, which is amazing, right? To forget that when this pain that consumed my whole life, that was my entire identity, I was forgetting that even happened. And I have this daily practice now of sitting with the absence of pain.
Mm.
And it's beautiful. So I'll just sit and I will, because I think we often focus on when we are in pain, and when we're not in pain, we're just like, okay, you know, might not feel quite good. But really sitting with that and just going into my body and like, I don't feel any pain and this is amazing. And yeah, it just kind of reminds me of where I came from, like my journey to here. And
yeah, I mean, that one day immersion, like the protocols are very simple again. It's like, well, you're only in that position. You play with the edges of discomfort was the language, right?
Yeah. That was critical for
taking
me.
Yourself beyond that, because what tends to happen is that fear response kicks in and our survival brain's like, ah, I don't want to get injured. I don't want to burn too much fuel. And you're governed by that. I mean, to a level throughout the day. Yet if you are a pain sufferer, then that's amplified, right?
Well, when you're a pain sufferer, you don't want to be in any discomfort.
No. So
you want to use the thing.
There's an immediate refusal almost, but there's playing with the edges. So you don't want to go to the point where, you get really triggered. And then what tends to happen, the convincing kind of saboteur comes in of told you so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that practice is done.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to many different modalities and practices, that language of play with the edge of discomfort. Don't put yourself to the limit. And I think we've just gone through, we're in spring now, right? So we can all reemerge, right? But actually, this for me is the new year. And in that January period when we should be hibernating and probably, you know, hand up, people have probably kind of hit it hard over the Christmas period because that's what we do. And yet we go New Year's Day, right, bam, and I'm straight into these practices. And the chances are that's not playing with the edge of discomfort. That's possibly going to trigger us. And then it's, again, validates the told you so.
You know? There was a lot of told you so.
And from the people around. It's not just from ourselves we're going through this huge transition and change. People are familiar with that old Tony or old Sam. And they don't want to lose that. You know, and it also means, well, perhaps I might have to change. Oh my God. And then that's triggering, isn't it?
My recovery has been very triggering for certain people around me. And I've had, you know, when I was talking about my marathon, my ex-husband said to me, do you realize how hard this is for me to see you doing a marathon after like all we went through with, because I mean, it had a huge impact on my marriage. You know, pain was the third person in my marriage. And he couldn't.
Well, at that point, he's married to different Sams, right?
Because
there's Sam when she's perhaps not in pain, there's Sam when she's in pain, and there's Sam when she's in chronic pain.
And he didn't know how. I mean, who knows how to cope with supporting a partner in chronic pain? It's really, really difficult. And and I think it was really hard for him to then see me start to get well after we'd separated, because you know, he'd only got to have bad Sam, in pain Sam, and now I'm emerging as this, you know, vibrant, you know, I say I'm not
marathoner,
I'm not just well, I'm thriving, like I'm you know, it's gone from illness to actually thriving,
surviving
and feeling alive, and you know, and yeah, so it's hard. And also, I think, you know, for some people, maybe if they're still stuck and then they see someone else who has gone through a transformation, it's like, well, like you say, I have to look at myself and do I have to change? And I can't change. And, you know, I know that Sam 7 years ago that was stuck in victim, that she would look at Sam now and say, well, good for her. She clearly doesn't have the same pain that I've got.
Well, it's back to that. Well, it is an endurance athlete conversation, isn't it?
And just wouldn't believe that the practices that, which are, have been so simple.
I know, and they're free.
Yeah. I mean, sitting on the floor and that playing with the edges of the discomfort, that was the key for me, because that was the 2 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 2 minutes, I've had enough. If I hadn't had that kind of language, I might have tried to sit for longer and maybe that wouldn't have been. But it
well,
was
that
like,
then leads to being detrimental again, right?
So I was sitting for 2 minutes and lying down.
Well, there's also the different...
Wait till I'm uncomfortable.
And the different sitting positions. So each one of those. I'll just unpack that for those that aren't familiar with ground sitting. But it involves being on the floor. That's the start. And you choose different sitting positions. And there's a large number of sitting positions you will see in nature. And if you have kids or you have witnessed kids on the ground, you will see a large number of those rest positions. They're like side sits, long sits with the legs out straight, squatting, kneeling. And each one of those, we could say, are foundational movements. So the more complex movement, let's say for Sam, for instance, going into, let's call it the supermarket. Let's move on. Let's call it the farmer's market or, the local regenerative farm to pick up some whatever. And that walking pattern is a complex movement, right? It's quite complex to balance this huge weight, the human head, above a very small base of support being the foot. Now, what enabled us to walk at some stage is getting the foundational movement. So the baby goes through all these movement patterns on the ground, the foundational movements, to be able to figure out how to balance that huge weight. And so they're the foundational movements of the more complex movements. One could argue your complex movements are only as good as your foundational movements, you know? And what we do is we go, well, here's a chair and sit down. And that chair has absolutely no overlapping kind of foundation into the complex movement. In fact, if anything, it's the saboteur of it, because it means that we're immobile in certain areas.
Yeah.
You know, so those ground sitting positions, that's what we're doing there, is we're playing with different rest positions for a period of time. And for some, it might mean being able to sit in what's called a shin box or a side sit whilst Netflix binging, rather than thinking, well, here's the couch and I'm going to get myself into a shape that would be the saboteur of me being able to walk into the next room.
Yeah. Ironically, I was using the sofa as my resting, you know, and actually it was causing me more.
Yeah.
But I think...
Even the mobility scooter, because it's a chair.
I know.
You know?
I know. Yeah. And I think like the sitting, you know, for me, that's definitely for my physical transformation. I mean, I know there's loads of stuff, you know, but if you say what's the physical practice that has influenced your body the most, it's sitting on the floor, just the sitting. But then you add in getting up and down off the floor multiple times a day.
Yeah.
And, you know, very quickly without doing sit-ups, or, you know, my core started to feel stronger. And my arms are stronger because I'm, you know,
getting
off of the floor. And so, you know, other parts of my body. And then I remember when I came to see you at the immersion, and, you know, all the physiotherapists had said, you know, oh, we need to work on your glutes and your core strength. And you went, oh, we need to work on your feet. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. Yeah. And then, you know, being barefoot. And so that in combination with ground sitting. Very soon after I started ground sitting, I also got rid of my bed and I started sleeping on the floor as well. And that made a massive difference.
Yeah.
So just slowly removing all of the comfort. But actually, you know, now I'm so resistant to sitting in a chair ever.
Well, yeah. Then you flip the discomfort comfort.
Like
the chair,
it's more uncomfortable for me to be in a chair.
And the ground becomes more comfortable again. And then that is not just the physical change, that's the mind again, right? The mental state of us, right? We can become much clearer. Again, we talk about breath work and meditation, all these practices. Well, if your meditation practice involves you sitting and feeling stiff and awkward in that sitting practice, how deep are you going into those practices?
Yeah.
Even the same for breath, right? Or even thinking happy thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, if the body's screaming at you.
Well, there are times I have to balance it, you know, like in a car, I have to sit in a chair. And, you know, if I'm in a group of people having dinner around a table, if I'm the one, you know, I'm then balancing the social need, right? So there are times, you know, when I'll be sat in a chair because, you know, that's the circumstances I'm in. But I'm much more comfortable on the floor. And even I went to Rongen's conference a couple of weeks ago. And 300 people all sat in their terrible, terrible conference room chairs, you know, facing the stage. And I just got rid of my chair and I sat on the floor at the front.
There you go.
And people sort of looking at me.
Mm.
But, you know.
Well, you're walking your talk.
Yeah.
Ground sitting your talk.
Yeah. And I'm not going to sit in a chair for 6 hours in a, you know, because I know that that's not going to be beneficial.
Again, unless it's an unavoidable sitting scenario, like flying or whatever.
Yeah.
But then there's also understanding when we are in that shape that certain areas, when we stand up, aren't going to be operating as they should. So back to the feet, even like that foundation where we're going to work on your feet. And we don't really understand that so much, but the foot is a really amazing support, which then off that strong foundation we can have ankle mobility, and from that we can have knee stability, and from that we can have hip mobility, and then we can have pelvic stability and core stability, you know. And if you think of the chair again, well, I'm going to get locked up in the hips, I'm going to get locked up in the ankle, so therefore, well, what's the use of the core stability exercise? And I'm only getting stronger in the core stability exercise at doing the exercise, because the moment I go back to the chair again, it's become the saboteur of the areas that should be moving and the areas that should be stable again, right?
Yeah.
So I think as long as you're, even if you are, so this is to any listener, like even if you are driving or flying or you are at a conference and you're not so immersed as Sam and you don't feel like you can be on the floor for 6 hours at a conference whilst 299 other people behind you are sitting at you and you can feel their stare on your back. It's knowing that when you get out of that chair, you need to be thinking, right, okay, can I stack all those? And I often say, hold the back of the chair and do a little simple squat where you allow your heels to come up, drop, do a little bounce and then walk off again, right? It helps reset that posture.
Yeah.
So how did that feel, though? I mean, how did that feel to be able to sit there for six hours, you say?
About.
Wow. So that's a long time, right?
Well, so I went last year and did the same thing. And actually last year, because I move, so I'm not always just sat, you know, in one position, because you move when your body needs to move, right? And so basically you get a workout for 6 hours because you're moving through the different. And actually last year, it was uncomfortable for me by the end of the day, but a year on and it was fine.
And you're there getting 6 hours of mobility and movement in.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
It was absolutely fine. And the kind of the social element of it last year was a bit kind of, oh, I'm the weird girl sat on the floor. Whereas now, you know, I am happy to be my authentic self. My authentic self sits on the floor. And, you know, actually, if someone is going to look at me weird, like I might encourage a conversation with them. I'll explain to you why I'm sat on the floor. You know, I'll talk for hours about, you know, natural living and how it's helped me. So sometimes it encourages conversation. And actually last year, somebody did come and start to sit on the floor with me. So, you know, if I embody it and I show other people and they're curious and they're like, oh, you know, rather than feeling like I'm the weird girl on the floor, it's like I might inspire them to come and have a conversation with me.
You don't carry the torch, you are the torch. Just the behavior alone, right? If you really embrace it and you embody it, we're talking about embodiment again, right? To be able to sit and practice for that length of time. And floor sitting is an actual practice, I think, for a large proportion of us, unless you've grown up in, again, of a culture where you just didn't have chairs and then it's just normal.
Yeah.
And this brings it back, I guess, to tribes of influence again, right? Mm. You know, if you think to Sam Fire now to Sam Fear then, right? And how that it's not just the ground sitting. It's not that. It's actually the communities now that you're immersed in that are enabling that. For you to really kind of own it, right?
Being in you know, the Nat Life Tribe community and other communities that I found myself in, and just, yeah, being accepted and able to be me without judgment. And, it's just encouraged me to be like, okay, well, this is me. And, I mean, anyone who's going to criticize me for sitting on the floor or, you know, think I'm weird or whatever, I'm not in pain anymore and I don't care. You know, it's kind of, you know, you can think that, but actually if you want to hear my story, you'll see why. And I'm not going to try and convince you that you should sit on the floor, but it's worked for me. And yeah, you can think I'm weird, but I'm not in pain. So I'm not going to be in pain to conform to your norms. I'm going to do what's true to me and
Brilliant.
Not be in pain anymore.
Brilliant.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas a few years ago, that wouldn't have been the case.
Well, we can become a conformist quite easily, can't we?
Yeah.
And I think there's a certain environment that nurtures that, which is the school environment, right? Because again, if you don't behave a certain way, then it could mean being ostracized and then if we relate that to a survival perspective again, what that would look like within communities again, unless you conform.
Yeah.
So I guess it's then... It takes courage, though, Sam. So you have to kind of, you know, acknowledge that the courageous Sam for stepping outside of those norms, right? Because that's brave, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do feel brave.
How does that feel?
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had to be... No. I've been brave, you know, for a long time because I didn't give up and I didn't, you know, there were times when I was in that victim and I could have so easily stayed there.
The Nat Life Pod is a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. This is also what underpins our online community, the Nat Life Tribe. The Nat Life Tribe is a growing health and natural lifestyle community where we offer weekly natural movement sessions, breathwork sessions, and hold a check-in safe space for the community to share, connect, and raise a hand if help is needed. This is a great space to embody the practices that we often speak to on the Nat Life Pod. Full details on how to join the Nat Life Tribe are in the show notes. I hope to see you moving, breathing, and sharing in there real soon.
the London Marathon.
Yes, how did it feel? Oh. How was that?
That was very emotional.
I mean, even the training going, let's unpack the training leading up to it, because that's quite something, right? Just the, if you think about, I always say the same as endurance events or running big distances. If it's a race, it's not about that day. I mean, largely it's about getting even to the start line, you know, getting to that start line and the process we have to go through to get there.
There was a lot of process to get to that start line and walking to the start line. There was lots of tears and lots of, oh my God, I can't actually believe I'm about to start it, let alone like the finish line. But like just even getting to that point where I was at the start line of the London Marathon. And I walked it in the end. I wanted to run, but I was getting some knee niggles and I was getting some stuff going on. And I just thought, okay, well, I'm going to ease back and I'm walking it is, you know, I could barely walk to the bathroom at times in my past. So, you know, to walk it is enough. And I remember talking to you and I was like, how do I train for a marathon? And you just said, do a marathon. I was like...
It really surprises people when I say that. What? Yeah.
What are you talking about? You were like, Sam, just do the distance. And then, you know, the distance is then not a thing. And I just remember thinking you were crazy. And then it was like a couple of weeks later and you just went, have you done it yet? I was like, Tony, what? Like thinking...
What an unorthodox way of training for a marathon, I know. But it was walk the marathon, right? Yeah.
And you were like, have you done it yet? And actually it was part of the way you were just... Because I was like, you knew my history, you knew where I'd been. And you were just like, she can walk a marathon. You were like, just pick a Sunday, pick 6 hours. And I'm thinking, it's probably going to take me longer than 6 hours. But yeah, that just kind of dropped in my head. And then it was the December. So marathon was in the April. And then the December, I thought, I'll do a half marathon. And I thought, I found this route that was, I thought, well, I'll do it like the same terrain as the where the marathon's going to be. So I found this route that was 13 miles, went into London Bridge. And it had been snowing, so there was snow on the ground, it was freezing, it was raining. It was
like, everything it needed to be. Yeah, yeah.
And I, so I was walking, I was plodding along, and I did this loop that then came back to London Bridge Station. And I was knackered and I was wet and I was, you know. But I knew that it was 13 miles from London Bridge Station back to my car. And I thought, I'll just carry on. So I did. So I hadn't planned to do the marathon that day. I just thought, well, I'll do a half. And just something, I was like, I'm just going to see. And I thought in my head, what's the worst that's going to happen? I have to get a taxi. You know, I'm walking home. I'll just see how far I get. And then I did, full 26.2 miles.
So you've done two marathons.
Well, yeah. So that was my preparation for the marathon. And then I did the London Marathon. And that felt, I don't know, they felt different because that was lots of people around and the hustle and bustle and someone from the tribe, lovely Leanne, came to give me a big hug halfway.
Powerful, that. I love
actually,
tuning into that.
Do you know what, Leanne, oh my goodness, love Leanne so much for this because she came and met me halfway and then you kind of, you go into that, the worst bit of it, which is all around Canary Wharf and it's a city bit. So I kind of went off into that. I had wet socks because it had been raining at the beginning. And she sent me a message saying, you're okay. And I was like, can you get me some dry socks, please? My feet are rubbing. It was around mile 19, I think it was. And suddenly I see this goddess on a bike come towards me that is Leanne with a pair of merino wool socks that she's found in some random co-op somewhere. And she comes cycling at me. And then she cycled the rest of the way with me.
Mm.
And I... around 20, mile 24, I started getting real pain in my hamstring. I was getting all sorts of like really sharp, not sure if I can do it anymore. It'd taken me so long, I'd fallen behind the back of the marathon.
Yeah.
So there's road sweepers around me. And it's like mentally then I'm like, there's no cheering crowds. It's like they're cleaning up. I haven't
this
finished.
This is me now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was real. I was real in it. And Leanne was just there on this e-bike next to me, coming along with me. And then I got to the end and there's an alternate ending. If you finish past a certain time, you don't get to go through the big fancy tunnel. You have to go to a separate bit. We couldn't find it. So I was like walking and then found some people and I said, where's the finish line? They went, it's back there. And I'm thinking, you're kidding me. So I actually did more than a marathon.
There you go. Did an ultra.
Because I basically went and then finished the marathon. And then I'm in the middle of, it's like in the center of London near Trafalgar Square. And then I've got to get home. So then I've just done a marathon. And then I'm like, couldn't get a taxi. So then I'm like walking. I was, pretty achy. And then like on the train on the way back. And then I got a taxi back. I didn't drive back. But it was like, it wasn't just the marathon. It was the standing around for 2 hours before the marathon, doing the marathon, then trying to get home after the marathon. So it was a pretty big day. But it was, I've got my medal at home. And it's just a reminder, of how...
Well, again, what it takes to arrive at the start line.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's everything that it's taken to get to the start line.
Well, just even, like,
I remember... Unpack that whole story, right?
I remember when I dropped it into the Nat Life Tribe WhatsApp and I said, I've been offered a place at the London Marathon. And you were just like, what? Like, just even that you've applied, like, yeah. And at that point, I mean, that was November, right? So I started ground sitting in July and then November had it in my head that maybe I could do a marathon already, So it was so, so quick. And then I did it in the December and then again in the April. And quite symbolic, really, going from, I think actually walking it for me was probably better than running it.
Yeah.
Because it took 9 hours and it was a real pilgrimage and I didn't take any music with me. I wanted to be in it. And I was in it. There were some real pain cave moments but it felt like a...
It's a long time to be out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But again, the just the strength, like the I'd say of mind to that December to get to that 13 mile marker, because you've already created that as the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
And then to go, well, actually, no, do you know what? I'm going to go all the way back to the car and then to go and do the distance again. Yeah. That's huge.
It was pretty massive. It did feel, yeah. And I went into, so I got back to London Bridge Station and I was wet and soggy and my hands were cold. And there's a clothes shop there. And I went in and I got some gloves and I got a hat and I got a jumper because I was not really very well prepared for the weather. And the woman said, oh, what are you doing today? I said, well, I've just walked 13 miles. I think I might do another 13 miles. And she went, why? Why? And I went, because I can.
There you go. That's amazing.
Because I can walk. And now, dance is my favourite medicine because I couldn't dance. Couldn't move my body, and now I'm at ecstatic dance all of the time, moving, and I can move my body. It's such a celebration.
Does that take you into a point when Sam was dancing? Is that because you almost said I never, but is there a Sam that used to be able to express herself like
So I used to enjoy dance a lot. And then there was a period, although I never... So I have real strong memories of at certain points where I was really in the pain, like proper writhing, like just unbearable.
Well, you can see as you start to explain, already, you go into the shell of that, right?
So like proper writhing. And I have this memory of getting down on the floor, putting on Michael Jackson, trying to move my body and just trying to get out what was in my body. I was crying and I was just, singing and just in it. So there was something in me even back then that kind of knew to move, that would come out at times, but then would maybe get shut down by the fear. Sometimes when it really, we get to that really overwhelming point where it's almost like when it got to that point, like my body took over and was like, we need to move now. Now dance is a really conscious practice, And I go and I'm with the freedom of being able to move my body in whatever way it wants. And I don't care who's watching, and actually nobody around me cares who's watching, because they're conscious spaces that I go to.
They're also processing spaces. I look at movement, dance, expression. They're ways of processing. So if you were Robert Sapolsky, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, is the first time really I read anything about that understanding of downregulation, what it meant to be that parasympathetic, sympathetic. Years ago, that book, it kind of dropped in, I think, pre-Lola days, really. It must be about 17 years ago, right? Something like that. And the zebra, of course, why the zebra doesn't get ulcers, the lion's hunting the zebra. Now, the zebra is even going to get eaten, or the zebra gets away.
Mm.
And then the zebra goes through its self-regulating practices, which is tremor work, down-regulates, and then it's all the systems that it shut off to fuel itself to get away, which would have been digestion, hormonal, and immune system, right, all suddenly reboot again, so the zebra can go back. So, of course, you're not going to get ulcers, right?
Yeah.
And dance for us, the way I see it, and what has perhaps been cultured out, it's a remembering now. There really is a remembering. That's what I feel like the ecstatic dance is doing.
Yeah.
Not that we didn't have a remembering in the rave scene, but ultimately it meant like popping pills and taking drugs to get to that heightened state, whereas we already have that. And you can just imagine like the Europeans arriving on far distant shores and seeing the savages, you know, naked, dancing, you know, this amazing rhythm, and there's something in that. It's not just about dance. There's a processing, tremoring that comes through it, right? The vibration of that.
Well, I find that ecstatic dance sometimes, depending on my mood. Like sometimes, actually, I've sat and cried. You know, I've actually just been with the vibrations of the music, with the people and the energy around me, but actually my body hasn't felt like it wanted to move so much, and actually I've just sat and cried, and then maybe got up and then had a move, and just really tuning in and being in these spaces where that's okay, you know, not being in a nightclub and then suddenly you're on the floor crying and people going, what's, you know, and because everyone's pissed around you, and you know, like the removal of alcohol from my life was just, you know, I mean, it was adding to the inflammation. I wasn't sleeping well, I was pissed every night, you know.
Well, you're in a permanent state of, well, making do. We're not even making do at that stage, right?
Just... Yeah. And I thought at the time it was the only thing, really, despite all of these really strong medications, it felt like alcohol was really the only thing that touched my pain or made me be able to function. And then I couldn't function because I was drunk. So it was,
or then,
you know,
dealing with the hangovers and everything else that comes. We just had Andy Ramage on about the... alcohol-free and what that did for him, you know, because again, we talk about meditation and breath and movement and all these getting your needs met, but he was doing all that, and then finally his secret sauce, or the secret, was to give up the sauce.
Yeah.
You know, for him. And it brought everything together.
Yeah, and it really, it enables you to, you know, rather than get drunk and go and dance, and you're not really in it, you dance and you're aware and you're conscious, and in these spaces, no one else is drunk either. Everyone's in it together.
I think it helps to unpack a little about the ecstatic dance and the process, because if you were to just hear this right now and you go, well, actually, I have social anxiety, so I use alcohol to enable me to go and have social experiences, to be able to get through the door to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I'm in that environment, of course, I've had a few drinks, so I continue drinking. But that enables me to lose my inhibition, so I'm then prepared to dance.
Mm.
You know, so there's a process there, and there's a process within the ecstatic dance, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just you arrive, music's on, and everyone starts dancing. Yeah. So that process, it'd be good for you to unpack that, what that looks like, or what that felt like for you, right?
My first experience of ecstatic dance was at the 100 Human Experience.
Another great.
Plug for you.
Plugs. We've had the Nat Life Tribe. We've had the 100 Human Experience. We've had One Day Immersion.
So, yeah. Okay. There's Nat Life Coach.
Oh, we get to that. We get to that final one.
Because
you're a Nat Life Coach.
I am a Nat Life Coach. So the first experience was at the 100. With Chris's amazing music that just transports me to another.
Great playlists.
Yeah, it's always really good. And I was still in a fair amount of pain then. And what was really interesting was I just, because the container was set, so we had done other stuff, and actually we had come off the back of Jeff's very powerful cacao ceremony, where I had bawled my eyes out and really, you know, we'd done breath work and we'd done a whole bunch of stuff. I think we'd done the ice bath maybe that day as well. So we'd done a whole lot of stuff and we'd done it all together as a 100. So it was, you know, all together. And so by the time we got to that point, actually, you know, we'd done a bunch of other stuff together.
And you're in a real safe
container. Kind of knew some people. And then, you know, the setting up of the ecstatic dance, so that, you know, the facilitator, I think it was Nina that did that, you know, taking us through a process of what we were then going to be doing rather than just we'll switch the music on and have a dance, right? So there was, you know, and every ecstatic dance that I go to, everyone that Chris has done at the 100 since, there's always, you know, some stuff going on, maybe some movement practices that kind of get brought in, or you know, some exercises to kind of help you
check in
that moment and ground and be ready for the dance. And then the music goes on, and then the type of music, you know, sometimes it can be quite tribal, kind of spiritual, but with a really good beat, and the vibration just always gets me. And and then it's just kind of, yeah, even that first one where I was still in quite a lot of pain that weekend, I think I was running on the spot at one point and I was like, you know, jumping up and down, and I was really in my body. And I think I was aware that there was the pain there, but I was just kind of able to move and completely free of the fear.
So moving through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was so in my own, I wasn't really aware of anybody else around me, actually. I was so in my own space. I think I had my eyes closed for a large portion of it as well. And I was just so in. So it wasn't about anybody else. It was about me. And then that was, that whole weekend was incredibly powerful. But I think the dance, because I hadn't been able to move or hadn't felt able to move my body in that way for such a long time, it was just like, this is it. This is, you know, I can do this now.
The freedom of that.
Yeah. And so now, you know, similar to the sitting with the absence of pain, dance is a practice of I can move, I can do this. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have the Hackney Baths and Ecstatic Dance UK, who just, they put on these amazing events twice a week in Hackney. So it's like, you know, I can go regularly to these things and the community there is amazing. And I can be on the floor rolling about, making weird shapes if I want to, and someone will get down and join me and do it. You know, it's not strange, or, you know, or I can sit and cry on the floor, or I can, whatever is coming up in that moment. And so there's that real freedom, or I can be a complete lunatic and just fling my arms around. And
it's removing all the armor, isn't it?
Yeah.
So getting back to, you know, if we unpack the needs again, there's movement in there, but there's the real need to express ourselves through an act of play, right? Very playful.
Yeah.
And think of how that is suppressed, or we believe it is. So therefore we do use substances to get to those states.
Yeah.
It's incredible watching it now and observing how ecstatic dance is blowing up and blowing up, and the more people are getting inside that reality bubble, and the healing that can come through that.
Yeah.
Because again, we're not talking movement as we see movement, perhaps through a lens of exercise, where it's reps and sets and pushing and pulling and resistance machines, and involves quite a serious kind of, I have to look a certain way, I have to wear a certain kit, my PE kit as an adult, let's call that. Whereas through dance, you can just, if you've given, and that's the other thing, is like permission, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
It's being given the permission at ecstatic dance in a way.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's great because I, at the last 100, at any ecstatic dance now, I'm a lunatic. I don't care. I love it. And at the last one, I did have a few people come up to me who said, it was so beautiful to see how free you were. It gave me permission to be free.
Mm.
And so that feels good now. Not only am I able to move, I'm able to move in a way that inspires others to move as well. And so that's really validating for me. And that's, you know, like the work that I now do is showing people the stuff that worked for me, and maybe it'll work for you too. And
yeah,
you know, that's, I try and embody everything that I'm teaching. Everything that I teach within my coaching and my therapy is stuff that I've done that has worked for me, that hopefully will work for other people. And yeah, and I embody that and just, you know, show people how I'm living.
Yeah, well, I think in the times of authenticity, yeah, if we don't embody a practice, I think it is felt anyway. If someone's voicing something from a place of just, because we're surrounded by information again, like latest podcasts, the amount of people I have just voicing around sleep, and it's like, how much are you practicing? And it's not embodied even. It's like, I'm going to get the next podcast, and then speaking to that as if that's the gospel. When actually, you know, are you really embodying this work? And that leads us into NatLife Coach, right?
It does, yeah.
Perfect. Well lined up, Sam.
See, I did that on purpose.
Sam's on fire. And on fire as a coach, a NatLife Coach now. You know, you came back. I really admire you for that. We just had Kate Casanova back as well. She came back to take the level one again, and just said, look, you know, there was a realization after the first one. She felt like she had to really go away and embody the practices and come back again. Because we speak to that on that level one. It's like, it's we're surrounded by information. This is how much are we going to go away and really embody this stuff to speak to it, and not carry the torch, be the torch. There you go. That's what I was voicing earlier.
It was really powerful for me, actually, because when I came in March to the first one, I was doing pretty well.
So let's
well, I've done, I hold on to do a marathon.
Let's talk about the marathon's in there.
Yeah.
And then there's a tidal pool.
Oh, yeah.
Down here in Porthtown. So the tidal pool is where we are on the North Coast. They were originally the communal baths for the miners, huge mining industry here for copper and tin. And 2/3 of the world's copper tin came from Cornwall. And these miners of that time were using dynamite to blow out areas of the rock so that could form a pool that they would then, that would be their normal bathing. So talk about, like, you know, comfort where we are today. That was just that. Oh, it was a joy for them to get in that water and clamber down the rocks to get into it. But I, it's part of my routine is to go to this tidal pool. And so on the coaching cert, that's what we did, right?
Mm.
You know? And so if we think about the marathon, yeah, that's one thing. But actually, to get down to that pool, if the tide is at mid to low or mid to high,
yeah, well, I mean,
you have to go down a rock face. You can't just clamber over a few rocks to get into it.
Yeah, and it was, yeah, pretty diagonal.
Yeah, it's steep.
Had to do a crab crawl forwards. That's the only way to really get down. And I remember,
which is that's the inverted crawl. It in context. Otherwise, we're just doing movement on the floor for movement's sake. But actually, well, let's put it into context. This is why you do that movement.
But that was a good moment, because I remember looking at it thinking, is he serious? We're really going down this? Okay. I trust you, Tony. And then I don't think anyone else would have got me doing that if it hadn't been you. So, yeah.
We did it.
And I'm crawling down this thing and, you know, literally like, doing a crab crawl down.
So you're facing down the rock face.
Really, really steep.
For those that aren't on video, you're facing down the rock face. Like a W shape. So you're looking down it, your hands are behind you and your feet are ahead of you and your legs are bent, and you walk with your opposite hands, opposite foot, opposite hand, opposite. So it's a contralateral crawling pattern, but inverted. So you're looking up or looking down in this case.
And it was, we got about halfway down and someone suddenly shouted out, you wouldn't get your mobility scooter down here, Sam. And I just was like, fuck, I'm like halfway up a rock face. What? My life is so different.
Yeah.
And it was really, that was quite powerful for me. But the difference from March to November was, really, like, I felt so much more able to, you know, particularly with like the low gait stuff and the, you know, the more strenuous stuff, I felt able to do it a lot more than I did. I mean, what, you have me jumping off boxes as well in March as well.
Well, balancing on beams and jumping from one beam to another beam and landing in a deep squat.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, all hanging patterns, low gate crawling patterns, and yeah, it's all there. And also we have presentations, and some of those are for a few hours. And we're ground sitting throughout that process too, right?
And I was able, and I was doing stuff in the March, but it was still a challenge. And then come November, which is only, 6 months later, something like that, the difference in me, and it was a real, like, bookend to, at the time of, like, well, this is, because you say about the journey, it's been a journey to something, and then a journey to, it's been a continual, you know, there's so many different, you could separate my story out into so many.
Well, you're moving the bookend.
Yeah. So yeah, that was really, really, quite significant to me to then come back and do it again and feel stronger. And I kind of, at the moment, I'm in this process of, okay, I've done all this work to get myself well, and now getting strong. And that's where the samphire is, right? And I actually feel I did a play fight recently, which was, it's a beautiful practice, and it was held very well.
Like roughhousing, yeah.
Well, this was like a proper, we had a circle, and, you know, and I'm play fighting with a guy who is probably stronger than me, but holding my own and pinning him to the ground and realizing, actually, do you know what? Like, I'm not just well, I'm actually strong, or I'm getting strong and wanting to get stronger. Like, I've never really felt physically strong. And I'm starting to feel physically strong, which, you know, that then brings in more of an element of safety. Like, I can defend myself if I need to, or, you know, just feeling safer in my abilities to be able to, defend myself, or,
well, it's
or my family.
I speak to that, like, the resilience that is needed for the ever-changing experience we do call life, right? Mm. And again, if the life just gets more and more comfortable, everything else outside of that is more uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, walk into the shops, that can be uncomfortable. I can stay at home and swipe a screen down and press a button.
Mm-hmm.
And where does that then get me in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, that level of comfort that comes in,
mm-hmm.
you know? And again, look at that playing with the edges of discomfort, if you call that even a bookend that you keep just edging, even chapter by chapter by chapter by chapter, look at the extraordinary change that can occur, and you are totally testament to all of that. You know,
thank you.
You should be very proud of yourself there. You know,
I'm very proud of myself. And what is the most amazing icing on the cake is that I get to go and help other people, but also my children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they've seen a mum who was, you know, drinking on the sofa and frisbeeing an iPad at them because she couldn't cope with touching them or doing anything with them. And now I'm play fighting with them. I'm climbing trees. I'm, you know, going out walking with them. You know, the difference between, you know, then and now is like night and day, you know, completely different mother. And so I get to help embody these practices around them, teach them, pass the baton down, right?
Yeah, through observation. They observe it because you are the embodiment of them, rather than just the I grew up with this language, right? It was do as I say, not as I do.
Same.
Yeah. And imagine, like, the lens of that, like the hypocrite of that, right? And kids see through it, right? So again, if you're a parent who's on a screen and then bashing your kids for being on a screen, and they've learned that from somewhere. It's an observed behavior. I think it's very powerful. And there's also the healing, I guess, within that communication, Sam, for you, right? Going from there's guilt, right, for being in that position and not having the time with the kids, or for throwing the iPad at them. And then there's the acceptance of that, which it sounds like you're at. And then the embodiment of now, look, they're observing. So they've got to witness someone going through this huge transformation, which speaks volumes. Mm-hmm. You know, how relatable that is for people that might be listening, but for kids to witness that I could be at this position. We could call that rock bottom, right? Mm-hmm. And rock bottom becomes the foundation of which to build ourselves from, right?
Yeah.
And they've witnessed that.
They have witnessed that.
And the Sam fear to Sam fire moment, right?
Yeah.
Moments, we could call that.
And the powerful message that I did it myself, you know? And there's a level, it was very difficult when I was in that victim mode to have that self-responsibility. I need to get myself out of this. No one's going to fix me. No pills, no surgery, you know? And none of that helped at all. I had to fix myself. And so to then be able to say to my children, well, here's a bunch of tools. So you're not stuck going, oh, I don't know what to do. Like, I know what to do. I've got these tools. And, you know, my son uses breathwork. He reminds me sometimes. He'll come over to me if he sees me getting a little bit upregulated and he'll go, right, let's do some breath, mummy. He's nine, right? And he'll come over to me and he reminds me. And, you know, communicating with children, allowing them to see our different emotions. You know, if I'm feeling upregulated because something's happened in the day, because of course I do, because I'm human, because things happen.
Being able to express it.
I'll communicate to them and I'll say, you know, there was a moment the other day where, you know, I felt a little bit triggered by something and I just said to the children, you know, I'm feeling a bit upregulated now. So, you know, let's dim the lights and let's, you know, sort of quieten down. My son came over to me and he said, Mummy, just remember that these feelings, they're not permanent. They will change.
Mm-hmm.
And all feelings are welcome.
There you go.
And I'm like, I've created this nine-year-old sage who just comes up to me with these little things. And it's like children, they do listen and they do absorb it. And then they will go on to, you know, to replicate this.
But they carry the baton, like, exactly, of that next leg of that.
So I feel so...
lap of the thing we call life, right?
Yeah. I feel so joyous that I'm in this position now where, yes, there was guilt. There's not anymore because I, you know, I've spent a lot of time with past Sam recently. I took her for a walk recently. I went for a walk with past Sam.
Great, that practice.
Yeah. So I went back to the sofa at my old house where I used to sit all the time. And I went from that sofa, imagined me and past Sam holding hands, right, and walking down the street at her pace. And what was interesting was I started to get some pain in my lower back, right, which wasn't there before. And then I took her for a walk and we went and sat on this. So it was a walk that I would do where I would walk to this bench, which would now take me 5 minutes, but at the time would take like 20 minutes to get to because I'd be going so slow. And I sat on the bench with past Sam and I burst into tears and I just allowed myself to feel whatever it was she was feeling and go through that process. And I sat there for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and then made the walk back and the pain had gone from my back. And and just really tuning in to how she was feeling back then. Because like I say, sometimes I forget. And actually, if I'm going to be working with people that, you know, past Sam, that's my...
Yeah,
that's
my target audience. You don't want to disassociate in that sense.
Yeah, I need to still have that level of empathy. You know, I think sometimes we try and disconnect from our past self because it's like, well, I'm not that person anymore. So I'm just, I don't want to think about that. And actually, I think if we're thinking that, then we maybe haven't done all the work that we need to do because past Sam's part of me. And she's my biggest cheerleader. She sat there going, fuck yeah, look at you. You're going down a blooming rock face and you're doing marathons. She's looking at me going, what? I never thought we'd get there. So she's like the biggest reminder, my biggest cheerleader. And she's my target audience now. And so if I completely disconnect from her, I'm going to be disconnecting from the people that I want to help.
Well, she's also taking you through a process so that you can remember who you are and why you're here.
Yeah. And she did what she, you know, the guilt is not there now because I understand. She did what she needed to survive at the time. I didn't have the skills. I didn't have the support. I didn't know what to do. And so all of the behaviours, whether it was shouting, whether it was ignoring my kids, whether, you know, whatever the behaviour, they were survival strategies.
Symptoms.
And the only thing I could have done at the time. And I couldn't have done anything different because I didn't.
Yeah.
I did what I did. So, yeah, so there's been a moving through the guilt and more now it's just rather than looking back and wishing that I'd done differently, I couldn't have done differently, just really... being joyful in the moment now that I get to live this life now.
Well, it's the, again, cliche of it didn't happen to me, it happened for me, right? So it's all unraveling.
If
we really own that language, it's all just unraveling exactly how it is. And who's to say that within that spiral of the way I see it as a spiral rather than a circle, is that we have moments where we're like, yeah, it's amazing. And who's to say there aren't going to be other moments when we're like this?
Mm-hmm.
But that having gone through processes, and I've gone through enough of my own shit to know that, as soon as I can get my narrative back to, oh, this is happening for me,
yeah,
the less time I spend in the victim of that.
Yeah. And I have a huge amount of gratitude for the sort of 10 years. Mm. You know, people think they're like, what? You're grateful that you went through all that?
Make peace of it. That's and the it's best like, part of the healing.
If I hadn't gone through that, I wouldn't be who I am now. And who I am now, if I look at Sam before all of it, you know, there was a whole load of stuff I was avoiding even before any of this, right? And I wasn't living authentically. I changed myself completely to be with partners or to have friendships. And I wasn't being authentic. And yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on for me before I even went through that. So having to go through this challenging, you know, pain and the trauma and losing my dad and all the stuff that happened, some of it, I wish my dad was still here, you know, but he's not. And I can be grateful for the lessons that I've learned from processing my grief around losing my dad, from the process of recovering from that pain. So there is a level of gratitude.
Well, it's also turning that round, you know, because you were a great support on the Man in March for Movember.
Mm.
And it's like looking at that relationship, and it was then that, this is important to me also.
Yeah. It's important to me because, well, I see the work that the men in my circles are doing with other men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of my dad, and like he had a serious mental health decline. He tried to kill himself, and then he was terminally ill anyway. And he didn't have that support. He didn't know where to go. You know, I look at my brother now who is struggling with things, and I want to be able to help him. And it's difficult. And I look at the work that, you know, the men's work, and it makes me feel safe. You know, it makes me feel safe that there are men out there that are leading this work, that are trying to help heal or help our men heal, so that then ripples out into society, you know, and
where it becomes another template to be observed, right?
Yeah.
Rather than what can be the toxic traits that are being observed. And then it's no different to the mobile phone in the hand, that's a learned behavior.
And then I think about my son, and, you know, he is going to have better coping strategies because I'm in these worlds where I know people, you know, and he gets to spend time with my communities and he gets to observe that, you know, we can cry and we can be angry and we can pray, we can allow to talk about these things.
We can be all these things, yeah.
You know, and we can do it in a safe environment with other people who are looking out for us, who are not in competition with us, who are really rooting for us and really, really care. And it's not what my dad's generation and what that looked like for them.
The ridicule and everything else that comes through expressing, right?
The space to go and do that was down the pub, right? Mm. So you go down the pub, you get drunk, don't actually really talk about your feelings, just kind of cover it over. And then maybe if you got a bit too pissed, then you're suddenly saying stuff and then, oh, what have I said?
And then the next day, the regret of that.
Exactly. And then actually, because the other men maybe in that group, they don't have the tools to cope with that because we're not supposed to talk about that. Oh, I can't believe, you know, so actually, even if you do share stuff, the people, they don't have the tools to hold it. Whereas now, you know, in these groups, in this work, people that have the tools and the space to be able to contain whatever's coming out and encouraging it and bringing it out. So... as a woman, it makes me feel very safe that there is this men's work going on now.
Yeah, I've mentioned this on the podcast in the past, about the 100 human, especially when there was a sharing, and what came in, what dropped in, was the women feeling safe because they felt that the men, and it was particularly men that had been doing the work, what that means, you know, that meant they felt safe. So that's incredibly healing also for the men that are doing the work, yes, or looking at entering that world and entering the work and entering the circles and sitting with other men and learning how to express themselves again, because it's only a remembering.
Yeah. And we're never really doing...
When we come out the womb, we are nothing but a pure expression, right? We just, you know, and then we're handed rattles and toys and a load of paraphernalia just to keep us quiet and numb us, because no one wants to hear the scream in the room or the cry. Mm. So it's... And then just a number of distractions to remove ourselves, or I guess confuse us even with what those emotions are. Because imagine you're expressing something and the parent, ill-equipped to be able to understand what the emotion is, goes, oh, here's a pacifying dummy. I mean, even the language of that, you know, and or it could be something else, and we're meddling with needs here and the full understanding of what those expressions are. So it is only a remembering. I really believe that. And it's, again, seen as a natural template that men and women have sat in circles for thousands of years, right? Mm-hmm. We've just had a bit of a pause.
Yeah.
Nice to know we can just remember, you know?
Yeah. Good to remember.
Good to remember. That's a good place to finish, right? Mm-hmm. It's always good to remember. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Sam. How was that?
Yeah, it was good.
We did it.
We did it.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did it. Come on, let's have a hug. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Tony.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences, or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at The Natural Lifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love.